Today we'll discuss and introduce a few more concepts, and hopefully with everything we do today, we get to where I think we should be able to. Then I'm going to leave the last lecture to go through a few specific examples, so everything has been rather terse and arid, but I want to get to the end of the concept so that we can then take a few examples and work them all through. So at the end of the first lecture, we're just trying to compute what's the analog of a vector in our spacetime. And we know that we said, oh, given a manifold, we define a tangent vector space at a point, which will be the collection of all the potential objects that measure the rate of change of this curve at that point, and it's a map that takes us into the real. We work out through this example, or this expression, by defining as many maps as we needed so that we end up doing calculations that we know how to do. So we relied on maps to Rn, if this manifold is n-dimensional, maps from the reals into the curve that parameterize the curve, and map from the curve into the real, which gives us those real numbers which define the vector. All through, of course, this could have been any curve. So we end up with an expression that says df d lambda, which is now a vector, associated to the curve f, was given by this. So here we have values, and here we have the gradient. So let me, for the sake of the argument, remind you of what a vector was, say, in this Euclidean, an Euclidean space. One way of representing a vector, it's called the vector A, was, and I'm immediately going to start putting more more indices here, but you would have perhaps written down the following, A sub I, E sub I hat. I mean, for instance, in 2D that spacetime, you would have maybe done A1, A2, or A1 I hat plus A2 J hat. These were unit vectors that allow you to then express a vector with particular directions. And if I and J were normalized and orthogonal, then you have a very nice expression and very nice understanding of what this vector is. And maybe you denote it this way. This was what gave this object its character, which was the vector, which this collection of vectors. And these are a collection of numbers that basically tell you the strength along each direction, or the projection along each direction. So we're slowly going to start to build up a notation here. If it is a vector, we're going to use something called the abstract index notation. I'm going to put an index A, so forget about this one for a second. And here, this it will look like a little bit of an abuse of notation. But let's do the following. So anytime. OK, these are awful. Let me use B here so that we don't have so many A's. So if I put an under bar to the index, we're saying this is something that you're evaluating. It's a particular number. So here we use also Einstein's repeated index convention. Every time you see something repeated, you have to understand sum through. So if we're in n dimensions, these are a sum of n different terms. And if it is just abstract, so we're not evaluating anything in particular, it just denotes the character of the object. So I see here something, a supra index, immediately that tells me that's a vector, or it's something that belongs to the tangent space, to whatever point we're discussing. And so that's a vector, and this is a vector, because I see that B. Eventually, once you get used to it, you're going to instinctively know the difference of where something is as a free index that is not contracted with anything that tells you that's a vector. And then this thing, you might just say, you might remove that. And then you're saying, oh, this is already being contracted. The only free index is a B, that then I have a vector as a result. For the time being, I'm just going to try and keep that notation. But you'll see as we go along how that abstract index notation is very useful. Not only helps you keep track of what objects you're working with, but also keep track of the type of calculation you're doing and the result that you should get should be. And again, as we go along, we'll do a lot more of these particular calculations to denote what it is and get more comfortable with that. So the other thing I'm going to say, well, this was a vector associated to the function f, but this was a general function, so we can even throw it away. So vector of associated to a particular curve will acquire its value once we stick in here the right curve that we're thinking about. And now in analogy with this, we're saying, well, these are things that first they have to be added up. There's sum over this pre-index u, right? If we have n dimensions, again, we have to sum from 1 all the way to n. And this gives us kind of the numbers. And this is the analog of the basis vector. But now, because we're working with something, first, we don't know what a unit vector is at this moment. We have to give more structure before we can say that. We just know that these are gradients along all directions of Rn. So they span our space, but they need not be normalized, not orthogonal. So they are independent vectors that span our space, our n-dimensional space, and we're going to use them to express any vectors. Of course, if this is not normalized, same thing here. If this were not normalized, then this guy changes value. We just had that the sum gave you the right vector. It's just this is a convenient basis in between quotes, but they are not basis in the way you would have thought of requiring orthogonality and normalization. Is there enough to express your vector? So we're going to introduce another object, which is going to have an index, the index in the opposite place. We're going to define something. So this was defined in the tangent space. Let's define the cotangent space. We denote it as this by tp, right? The tangent space at the point p. Here we're gonna, the cotangent will be tp star. That will be a notation. And that will be a map that takes any element here and sends it to the real. So let's say cotangent space are maps w that takes any element on tp and send it to the real. We'll see in a bit what how we're going to work with them. But in particular, it's something, again, it takes something here, takes you, gives you a real. And the notation would be now with the index down. A sub b, bless you. Let's say it's now, or let me just call it v sub b, e. B, E, E. Oh, let me just see now. Okay, so here's where we encounter again our convenient use of the abstract indices. I said this object, which is a distinct object of that one, and you've seen just a bit why this one has the index down, this why as opposed to this one, which would define having it index up. It still is. We'll have associated to it an expansion in terms of some co-basis, or as opposed as of this was a basis, this was a co-basis. The free index is down. That gives the character to the object we're constructing, and it has components here. If this, and that if you were working with bases that are orthogonal and normalized, what you would have is a dot product, and let me, for the moment, denote it this way, will be given by delta bc, where this is a unit, so this will give you 1 if b and c are the same, 0 if they are not. Again, and slowly we're going into defining on inner product, but I'll do that in a few minutes. Let me just say a few more things. So here, this was a tangent space. This was a cotangent space. But you could imagine making space that are larger by a collection of these. So if I have the direct product of many of these tangent spaces, so I can have TP by TP by TP. By that, you're saying, so this is a space, and I can take elements of that space, do the direct product, and just make a space that is higher dimensions. The same thing here. So we're going to define a tensor, which is the generalization of this and that. We're going to denote it with T. And this tensor might have, say, n entries in TP. Let's label A1 to AN, and m entries in the cotangent space, B1 and BM. And we're going to say this is an object of type NM. So far it's notations, but I have to give you something more. This is going to be not every object that has indices that way will have the right properties of a vector. A covector is cotangent space. Sorry, that one was a vector. Sometimes this one is also denoted as a covector just because the index is down and it's this R map. Yes.
So I just wanna see if I understand this clearly. So the tensor, we can relate it to a higher dimensional space that's just like the direct product of.
Yes, right. Spaces. You can have as many of those, and very soon we're going to introduce two tensors that are very important in the derivation of Einstein's equations. That will be 0,2 and 3,1, if you want.
What would we call that? So we call this like tangent space and cotangent space.
Yes.
And covectors. Is there like a space we associate with the tensor?
No, it's a direct generalization by direct product of many of elements in the tangent and the cotangent.
Okay.
And you'll see these later on, we're going to try and describe properties of these. We're going to keep relying on these other ones. And you'll see once we introduce an inner product, and in fact, there will be a natural map between one into the other one by this special tensor that we're going to introduce in just a short while.
Wait a minute.
Yes.
From one like larger space to a different.
From the tangent, no, from tangent to cotangent, and then you can make any nm as long as you keep the total fix n plus m. You can go from 0 n plus m to n plus m 0 just by the appropriate computation that we're going to do.
Yeah. Okay.
For the index. For the up indices of the tensor, can we, so there are elements of the tangent space, and they map objects inside the cotangent space to the reals?
Right, but now we're going to have our n copies of, right, if I have n of these, I'm going to have n reals, right? Or n and n plus m reals. Right, thank you, that was a very good question. But we need to also make sure that we're going to call a vector if it transforms in a special way. So let me just, let's go back to our definition of a vector there. Say df d lambda is dx mu lambda d dx mu of f. Now let's imagine you're here. And you choose a different set of vectors or basis vectors that you're going to use to express them. So then you might have the basis vector dx prime u, so you chose rather than using the x's, you're going to use the x primes. So this will transform, well, as you know, dx d mu. Dx prime, I'm going to do it, so Yes. So here is this, if you want, the Jacobian takes us the x prime into the axis. So the we will transform this if I use that. So the relationship of the vector, so the vector, if it transforms in the following way, so as you change your coordinates, the relation between the transform vector and the original vector, let's give it by this. So if an object does not if an object that is a vector does not transform in this way, we're not going to call it a vector. It will be an object that has n collection of entries, but we're not calling it a special vector. Associated to that vector and the covector, we're also going to have an analog definition. If it will be a covector, if it transforms, let me just call it v a prime. So a covector or an object that has an index down will be defined as a covector, or will have the properties of a covector, and therefore will be called a covector if it transforms this way. And by analogy, the same thing will be true for any tensor. Of course, what you have is now a collection of these objects associated to each entry that you have. Right? You have n Jacobians for this, m Jacobians for that other one. But they are flipped in the order. So a tensor, so T will be a tensor if T, oof, this is going to be long, A1 prime, AN prime, B1 prime, prime, T alpha 1, alpha n, B 1, n. And I'm just putting the parentheses there for sake of presentation. Of course, we don't need them. Yes?
Can you give us an example of like some things that look as if they should be a vector and a tensor? But
we're going there. Okay. Yeah, thank you. In fact, this is the reason why we introduce it. And let's suppose, let me see, do I want to do that right now? Yes. Suppose I take this vector, I have a vector v, let's see, let's take a vector, let's call it w u prime, and we want to take v prime, like that vector, and we're going to take a derivative. And then we're going to ask, is the object that I get after I take the derivative a something that transforms properly? And if it doesn't, then we're going to say the result of the derivative of the vector is not a vector, is not a tensor. So I take a derivative, and what derivative? Let's take the derivative one we would know. Or this the only derivative that so far we have been working with, which is the partial derivative. So let's take du prime, which is the of that. But of course, if this object were the result, so now we're going to have two free indices, or two indices, so the object would be a tensor. And if it is a bona fide tensor, it will have to satisfy this type of transformation. We're going to ask, does it do it? So if we do that, of course, we could take the derivative in the prime basis or in the non-prime basis. This is what we're trying to compare. So this operator will be dx u prime cu. And now we want, I should have flipped this.
Put this. The subscript underneath the W, is that a V or a U?
Here?
Yeah.
V.
Okay.
So let me do it this way. Okay, so here I'm just saying the derivative on ex prime of an object that now we're going to think as being written in terms of the non-prime basis. So we're using the chain rule here. And we're going to rewrite this guy in terms of the transform vector, because here we're saying this was a vector. So let's use the transformation here.
Wait, sorry, how does that chain rule work if you've got both the primes and the denominator?
Oh, sorry. This word, I flipped,
okay,
I lost it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Subscript should be V or something else.
The V will come in here.
Whatever, A, whatever, but it can't be U.
Well, he's just changing from the primes to
the
V. If you want, I could put alpha, alpha. Because I'm making the effort putting the prime, but that's okay. Thank you. So this will be, now I'm going to use that. Where was it? Here. So we're going to have things. Let me just denote them this way. The And now you can see what's going to happen. So once we act with the derivative operator, we're going to have a derivative acting here times one Jacobian, two Jacobian. That piece is OK. It's the piece we expected if this, the result of our operation was a tensor. But we also have another piece, which is when this acts on here. And when it acts on here, it gives us a piece that we don't know what to do. This would not satisfy the properties of transformation of a tensor. And what we have now is something else. We don't know what it is. We can definitely do that calculation. And at more than one instance, we will be doing it. But what we also want is perhaps having a derivative operator that, if taking a tensor, gives us an R tensor. Tensor, a new tensor. Of course, it will have an extra index, so it promotes the type of tensor that we get to a higher dimension, or a higher contact one, or a one with higher level of n or m, depending on the type of derivative we're taking. But we need to go here, and this is what we're going to be then using to define a new derivative. But before that, let's just introduce another object. And that object will be the metric tensor. We'll introduce something. And the reason we're going to introduce a metric tensor is manifold. So in particular, we've said at the very beginning of the first class that forces lose any meaning, masses lose any meaning, but we kept going. There was a special trajectory in our space that those are still solid. We can still rely on them. And computing, and then we also said that we want, say, a definition or a notion of locality. If it is a small enough region, we can do physics as we know. So we keep thinking that distances are important. So a metric tensor is something that will let us calculate distances. We also know from special relativity that we have trajectories that are, say, slower than the speed of light, at the speed of light, or faster than the speed of light. And so we have a notion of causality. So metric will give us a notion of causality. And associated to that, we're going to introduce we're going to remind that this object so knows about that. So first, calculate distances. Well, from using our our fundamental or basic knowledge of geometry. So this is like computing some small displacement. And if we think of, again, Pythagoras, or we're thinking of saying, oh, we need to do things like this, et cetera. But now we need to generalize it, so let's do it this way. So if we think of trying to compute the distance between two points and having some associated sense of directions or bases, well, this may be a displacement along this direction, that direction. So let's this way. Of course, this GAB happens to be, and this now think of it as a matrix, some object that may have, say, 1, 1 in two dimensions, 0, 0. This will give us, again, dx squared plus dy squared if our labels for a equal 1 for dx and a equal 2 is b. But in general, we're going to have something more complicated. We also want to make contact with causality, and for that reason, we're going to actually have a minus 1. So here, Minkowski metric comes in, so that now, for instance, if this is, if x1 is t and x2 says x, now that will be minus dt squared plus dx squared. And this will give us a natural way of telling different trajectories apart. We're slowly building up the notion that there is a null cone. And trajectories along or inside that cone will have this distance being negative. Trajectories tangential to this, where dt is equal to dx, which then, if you want, means dx dt is equal to 1. If we think 1 is the speed of light, then this will be null. Trajectories will be objects that have ds equal to 0. And if it is positive, this will be space-like trajectory. Yes.
Is this fully general, or is there another way you could potentially, or like, are there more ways you could get a notion of causality that aren't necessarily with like a negative time, positive spatial?
Okay, so your question is very good. Let me just say, so first there is a convention where you choose negative, zero, and positive. That's just convention, and people can do it.
Other than just the different conventions, is there a more general way?
There are. So people have entertained like signatures where you have a few negatives and several positives. So you could have, in four dimensions, two negative and two positive. It's a generalized sense, but we don't have, in physics, we have the idea, okay, there's one way to the future, and it will be anything within that code. So this is what we're doing. And then this metric, because of this, is going to have, is going to be referred to as being pseudo-Riemannian. Or Lorentzian.
Mean in this case?
So, good. Riemannian means all signs are positive.
Okay.
And pseudo-Riemannian, one of them will be negative. Or Lorentzian.
For example, for D, if we had two negative and two positive, is the consequence that we can define two independent notions of time-like curves?
Yes, and then they can be disconnected. So I don't know how to do physics there. So people have entertained to do something, but I haven't paid attention to it. Do physics, this is to make contact with the physics. Like, well, no, this suffice. Or this is the right way of doing it. Yes.
What is the deeper motivation between like introducing metric as a rank two tensor? Like, why can't we have like something like G A B C D and then D X A?
Good. So, now excellent question. So first, we're trying to say, have a notion of a distance in whatever dimension of space you have. So you imagine that you can connect that. If you have an RM, let's say an M dimensional space. If you have M kind of directions, that you can build your path towards that point.
At some limit, it should be a Euclidean metric.
At a limit, you should also want to make contact with Euclidean concept.
But But it's still like we can have some non-trivial ways to build this higher rank metric. I don't know, like, is there any specific motivation? Like, because I've never seen
more
introduce a metric which is like.
Because this with this one, you can do all that you want, right? You want to make, want to compute distances, and this answer is the displacement square, or the addition of this, the square of the displacement, and then you take the square root. Again, if you, I'm just repeating what you have in Euclidean, and you don't need more structure than that. You're trying to introduce the minimum amount of structure that gets the job done, and this is what. So we're going to have to be careful then when we discuss things, because the fact that, I mean, what we just said, there are some trajectories that have length, associated length that would be negative, some that the associated length is zero, and some that their associated length is positive. We're going to have to learn how to live with it. And in particular, photons or gravitational waves travel along this path. Soon we're going to introduce another concept where part of how to define it will demand us understanding what happens with lengths. And so that will mean trajectories along null cones we're going to have to be treated in a special way. So associated to the metric tensor, we're going to have things that we can do is just compute extreme so extreme of distances is what I was just kind of in a different way referring to. We're going to define special trajectories as trajectories that extremize the distance, either to make it the largest or the smallest. And this will have, at the face value, is something we can do, and it will have a very special meaning. Like the geodesics will be in there. We're also going to use the metric tensor to replace the gravitational field. Next week, when we cover Einstein's equations, we're going to see that we can make contact with a Newtonian theory by a judicious choice of the metric tensor. And it will, the information, I'll say, of the gravitational potential will be in the metric. Out of these, we can also define, we're going to be able to define dot product. So in particular, one of them, which is what I was saying before, if we have the vector acting with a covector, or let me put it this way first, we can imagine doing this computation. Remember, the covector was a map that takes elements of TP, which is are our vectors, into the real. Right? So this expression is something that takes us into the real, into the real line. So this again is something that we kind of have, we it resonates in our memory, the dot product of two vectors. We know the dot product of two vectors gives us a scatter, right? So here the way we're going to do this is the dot product of the two vectors does not exist just as it is, unless we define it in a particular way. And so we're going to define, for instance, the dot product of the vector BA with the vector MB is through the metric. So that's our dot product. And in general, we're going to be able to do all sort of products associated with the matrix and the metric tensor. And the good thing of that is that we'll take tensors into tensors, it might promote tensors to a lower index or an upper index, and we're going to continuously use the metric for that. And you're going to see why, in particular, one of the things we kind of just noted is that the derivative operator, depending on what derivative operator we have, we might mess up properties of tensors, while the metric tensors will not. In fact, the metric tensors is very unique because of that. And further, it will give us a mapping between, say, TP and TP, of course, and vice versa, by allowing us to bring one object into another one. So associated to VA, there is a natural, let me just for the sake of the argument call it W, because we've been using that. But there is a special W that is VA dotted with GAB. So I'm going to call it now BB, VA. So notice what this is doing. And we, if we use our abstract index notation, we already see immediately there is the A's are being repeated. So that tells us these two will get contracted, will be added up. And the only free index that I have at the end of the day is this B. As a result, we have something that should have the properties of a covector. And this was related to a question that we had before for a tensor. So if I have a vector, for instance, a tensor T, A, B, C, I can then, with the metric, construct the tensor T, A, B, C by simply taking this one, and let me call it A1, B1, C, and multiply by G, A, let me just do it explicitly, T, A1, B1, C, times G, A1, A, G, B1, B, is T, A, B, C. So I contracted this one. I ran with it. I have to sum them up. But this one gives me a free index A. Same thing with that one. And I'm not doing anything with the C. So this was now mapped the tensor that was a 3-0 tensor in a 1-2 tensor.
Define covector, we first have to define the metric
and give a dot product. So, great question. No, we don't have to have the definition of the metric to make sense of the tangent and the cotangent space. Remember, when we did it, we never made any contact with the metric whatsoever. If we have it, however, we have this natural way of identifying one space with the R1, and out of that, define further structure. And in generativity, we're going to always have the metric because it's going to be our fundamental object. So we're going to be able to do this identification and just work with it through.
We cannot introduce just any metric and then say that this metric can help us to like identify some unique objects in the cotangent space, like related to this tangent space. What are the special properties that a metric should have to like give us a unique way to find an object in cotangent space for any of the objects in tangent space?
So it will be that object that defines distances in your manifold. But it is true that given a manifold, I can imagine many metrics on it. And then Einstein's equations will be the one that will tell us, depending on the manifold you are and the sources in your spacetime, is the metric, the unique metric, the one that satisfies Einstein's equation. So that's the one that would pick their one.
A metric that can identify a unique covector in the cotangent space is the metric.
No, I can have many matrices.
But all of them.
But there's going to be one, which is the one we're going to be using to do physics, which is the one that will be solution of Einstein's equation.
I mean, just this mapping between tangent space and cotangent space, is it always unique? Like given any metric?
No. So if you endow your manifold with many matrices. With many matrix, then you can, having that matrix, for that matrix, you can always go back and forth. But what we're doing is try to get a way to obtain a unique one, and that will go through Einstein's equation. Right, all great questions. Just a few more notes on causality. So suppose you have some slice in your space. We can define, for instance, through the metric, given this point, what is its path domain of dependence, i.e., what physical information on this slice would determine uniquely the value that this point will have. And it will be this. Say, we will look for past null trajectories starting from that point. Where do they reach? And things that are here, in order to communicate with that point or affect that point, we'll have to be doing so acausally. will go faster than the speed of light, and we're going to say that's not allowed.
So
as we go along, we're going to keep coming back to these issues and define through these, for instance, black holes, the domain of dependence, the domain of determinacy. But in order to introduce these concepts, what we have to have is a notion of distances, which that requires a metric for us. Bless you. So let's just now try and jump in. Curvature, well, okay, let's 2 minutes or 3 minutes. Your name, where you're from, because we did this three. Let's do this three now. What do you do for fun?
So my name is Robin. Mm-hmm. I'm from Hungary. And then I like to play the guitar.
Oh, playing the guitar. Cool. There is a, you know, there is a band here or an orchestra. So. Yeah, and every now and then on Thursday nights, there is music that people can bring their instruments and play.
I am Ali. I'm from Iran. And, well, I like
to... You like what?
Working out.
Working out. Cool. Yeah, I saw you in the gym.
Wait, I didn't see
it. Yeah, I changed it.
Cool. I was in this gym too.
I'm Vasha. I'm Vasha. Where's Dasha?
Where's the second question?
Right. Matcha.
I'm from the United States of America.
Good, because I have a pet peeve with people calling America as a country, but I like that.
Right, yeah, because that's a continent. what do I like to do? I feel like I'm perpetually singing. That's I didn't do that a lot.
Okay, good. You can now we have a guitar player and a singer. We're getting to a band. Okay, good. So let's now we're gonna change gears. Let's go to curvature. Okay, so I'm gonna introduce a few more definitions, and I promise it'll be useful. Curvature. So it's something we're gonna construct out of our derivative, our metric, and our knowledge that things on a curved space-time are more complicated. So for that, we already said that this derivative, the derivative with respect to the natural coordinates you introduce with your chart is no good. I mean, it's not good, but it's not good for staying within tensors. Let me put it this way. So what we have is a kind of very quick, sloppy calculation that where we saw that once we computed, say, the derivative of a tensor, we got a piece that we knew we wanted to get, plus some extra stuff that did not satisfy the properties of the tensorial transformation. So what we're going to do is introduce some things that will correct that stuff. These things have a special name. And they're called connections, or as a Christoffel symbol. And it's important to stress the word symbols there, because the way we're going to denote the object will look awfully like what we've been calling tensors. So we need to make sure that we remember what things are tensors and what things are no. Now, I'll just give you the definition, and then we're going to go and work what these things are. That's going to be defined out of the metric tensor. And I'm going to give you a simple exercise to work it out. That was wrong. Let me just do it. A, B, C. Right, so again, if we look at this, it has all the kind of the shape and form of a tensor, but it's not.
Is the C first and then it's AB, or is it AB and then the C?
Good. So first thing. So this is C, C. The metric tensor, something I didn't say, is that it's great. So it's symmetric. So CD and DC are the same.
No, not that. Just like in the Christoffel symbol, like. Is the C first and then
it? No. This is a symbol, so you have to just.
Oh, it doesn't matter.
No, it doesn't matter. It does matter if you bring it down. Where it is important, but in this order, it's not important.
Okay.
or the symbol. We're going to introduce other things where these things will matter. But so this is something, and when we work out, and I'll show you in not too long, how we'll work with this. This will come in and correct the this bad property that the standard derivatives have. So how, for instance, if acting on a vector we're about to introduce this new derivative, which we're going to call covariant derivative. And this is one of three types of derivative we're going to introduce that respect this thing within a tensor framework. This would be perhaps the one we use, would definitely will be the one we use the most. So suppose you're trying to say, well, there is a derivative that when acting on a vector gives us, now I have 1, 2, 3 indices, gives us a tensor of type 1, 1. One down, one up. The object we know, at least to make some derivatives of, is this one. So we're going to use it, but we're going to correct it. So this will be given by the ABB. And I am already, kind of, let me just stress again, in this line I have introduced several notations at once. Comma stands for derivative. So F, comma A, the derivative A of F, which of course there is that is a, has an R notation associated to it, which is that, right? Sooner or later, you will encounter this one, and that will be that. So careful if you have a comma or not. With the note, in one case, there's a partial derivative, and the other one will know the covariant derivative. So be very careful with that. And some older references or books will have perhaps that one also for this one. And books that I cannot even open just because the notation is very kind of, I don't know, weird for me, will have these ones or the Christoffel. So just, I'm just warning that anyway. Typesetting is complicated. So how do we correct? We correct with this. And that's our symbol. So this symbol is that. Intuitively, you knew that something like this has to come about. Why? Because we're computing, we're constructing an object that has an index up and an index down. For each one of those, we need to correct the garbage that this one is leaving out that will not satisfy the fact that it's within a tensor representation. So you imagine for each A and B, you might have a combinations of different components of your V, the vector V, that are coming in to mess things up. So you imagine that, OK, you need an object that has these two indices plus a third one, which helps you use combine all the components of the vector. And it will happen to be this one. And the other thing, two more things we're going to make contact with, which will be crucial. So one will be a geodesics. We're going to have a definition of geodesics. And this will be the trajectories that satisfy a particular equation, which we're going to derive. Let me give you the equation first. And I put an equal in between quotes because this is a bit more general. We're going to discuss that. More often than not, we'll just stay with the zero. But depending on the parameterization, this you might have something here that is still left. That is non-zero, but it will have to be very special. And the other thing we're going to be able to do, all with this Christoffel, is define a new tensor, which is the Riemann tensor, out of which we'll do pretty much everything, which is defined And let me not give you the precise definition now, but it will be derivatives of these gammas and then products of these gammas. So I told you these gammas are not tensors. The derivative of something that is not a tensor has no chance of giving me a tensor back in general. But this particular combination actually does construct a tensor, which is central to the discussion of Einstein's equations. OK. And similarly here, you'll see that we're going to be able to write this in a way where the tensorial character shows up. So let's go by parts. First thing first, we need to define the covariant derivative. So being a derivative, we want it to satisfy at least some properties. Let me call it property one here, which is linearity. So we are denoted this by grad A, let's say. We want linearity, which means grad A of anything plus anything is the same thing as the grad of one plus the grad of the other one. We want Leibniz, so Leibniz property. We have grad A of F with kind of dotted in a particular way or producted with another thing to satisfy that. So this will require our covariant derivative satisfy. And then I'm going to put a property zero here. We're going to require that is grad f a of a function in our manifold is the same as the standard derivative, the partial derivative of the f. Remember, what is the derivative? What do we use the derivative for? We're using the derivative to compare the value of, say, something f with what it will be in the near neighborhood. And the problem we alluded to whenever we're dealing with curved manifolds, that it's hard to make that comparison because things can change, not because the vector has changed, but now because it's going around our manifold that is curved. But when we talk about functions, so functions are scalar, and comparing numbers is trivial. So it's a number. It's whatever number it has next door. And we should be able to then say that whatever variation is a true variation of the object. And so then that's what we ask that this compatibility holds. Yes.
What do you mean by the product of two vectors? Is it a dot product or?
Yeah, I haven't told you what it is. This could be tensors. So whatever, if I have an object here that is the result of the product or the judicious product, then you're going to be able to, or you should be able to, obtain the action of the derivative with respect to the product of these two objects as the action of one of the objects times the second plus this first times the action on the second one. We still have to say what this thing is. But so in particular, you could have said a VA WA, right? You could do that and then go through. One, and then it would be the grad on V times W plus b times the grad of w. And okay, that's an interesting way of now deriving. Suppose you know that line, that grad a b plus grad a b c. You see, I can ask, can you derive what grad a omega b is out of that and the properties? And the answer is yes. How would you do that? And I'll leave this as an exercise. The first thing we do is to say, notice when I can imagine, so if I know how to grad will operate here, I still have to define how the grad will operate there. But if I know how the grad will operate here, by that definition, I also know how the grad would operate on this product. Because what is this product? If I know that these two are repeated, that's a scatter. And we know out of this property how it should be. So you can combine those two things to arrive, and this, as I said, I'll leave you as an exercise, prove the following, that this and that imply that grad A WB is equal to A WB minus. Or the same gamma.
What is the first line? Was it supposed to be the gradient of VB?
Oh, sorry, this would be that way. Thank you. Prove that. The other thing I'm going to say, and this is a restriction that we're introduced here, and just keep with it. We're going to define that our metric and manifold and problem that we're working is so-called torsion-free. We'll see what this is in next class, I think. But what this implies is that this is true. And it's related to the question that we had before, that the Christoffel symbol is symmetric. If we don't require this, then that's no longer true. And the equations are much more complicated of the theory you would derive. But for our purpose, we're introducing the minimal ingredients that we need. And torsion-free is how we derive. I mean, that condition is a condition we want. And the last property, which is crucial, is that the covariant derivative acting on our metric, whatever indices you want, in whatever order you want, let's call it CD, is zero. So that says it's compatible with your metric. And it's a unique, if you put all this property together, there is a unique covariant derivative, which is good. I mean, if we had more than that, more than one, we would have to deal with that problem. So another exercise. So this is exercise one. Let me give you exercise two. Show that. So now this is the covariant derivative of a vector with the indices repeated. All right, so now let's just do this exercise. What type is the whatever answer of this operation is? What type is the answer of this operation? Is it a tensor? Is it a scatter? Is it a vector? What is it? Exactly, it's a scalar because these two things are. And what operation do you remember from calculus that acts on a vector using the derivative gives you a scatter? The divergence. Right. So this is just the divergence, the covariant divergence of that vector. Prove that this is true. Let me tell you in a second what the difference ingredients are. So this is 1 over a square root of the determinant of your metric, the absolute value. Again, we have to be careful when we compute determinants of a Lorentzian metric, because we have a minus 1 sticking somewhere. So this will give us negative. So we need to take the absolute value or put a minus sign. So this can be written like that. So for very special operations, there is a simple way to go around, if you want, computing all the Christoffels by just doing this. But this is for the divergence of a vector. There is a similar expression for the divergence of one leg of a symmetric tensor. We're not going to go there. But this will come in handy quite often, this particular expression. So prove this using, so compute the Christoffels. Because now you're computing the divergence, you're going to see that some of these objects will have to repeat so that you're doing the right index. So what I would do, what I suggest you do, write first the general one, and then it's all, but this B is A. So I can keep going, compute this one using that definition, and show that this is and for this, you might find it's useful to recall Jacobi's formula. So any change in the determinant can be computed as the determinant times the inverse of the matrix that of which you're computing the determinant times the variation of the matrix. And another thing that I don't think I stress, we introduce this matrix GAB. Associated to that matrix GAB, we have the one with the indices up, GCD. And because it's the inverse, if I compute kind of the dot product of one of the legs, this gives you delta AD. So this is the inverse of that. And remember how we use the matrix with the index downstairs, or the covariant version of the matrix, to lower indices of tensors? Well, then we can use this one to raise indices tensors. So just as before, where we took this one dotted with a vector to compute a covector, we can use this one on a covector to compute a vector.
How is the absolute value of G is defined?
Say again.
How is the absolute value of the G is defined?
So this is just, it's just to denote when you compute the determinant of the metric, just imagine that the metric, and I'm going to use a notation here, in flat space-time Cartesian coordinates, the metric happens to be minus 1, 1, 1, 1, say 3 plus 1 dimensions. So if I compute the determinant of this matrix, it will give me minus one, and I cannot take the square root of the minus one. But if I take the absolute value, that gives me one. And of course, here we recover, for this case, the divergence that we would know, right? Because this would be one, that would be one, and this would be just a standard determinant. This is the determinant of G. This one is the determinant of G. And then if you are with a Lorentzian metric, you take the absolute value, otherwise you couldn't take the square root. And stay in the reals, right? Okay, so one more observation. I said we're computing, so where do these things come from? Let me just give you another example. And we're going towards trying to define curvature. So slowly we're building to it. So suppose we are in flat space-time. Again, let's think of our triangle that we discussed the first class. And I'm going to take a vector. This is our green chalk. Let's start here with this vector. And let's parallel transport that chalk or that vector along this triangular path. So I go this way, I come in here, this way, I'll come in there, and around, and it coincides. So a parallel transport in Euclidean spacetime around the closed loop will give us back our same vector. But now, if we try and do the same thing over our sphere, so we start with this one. And once it gets here, the vector begins to kind of tilt inwards. And here it's pointing that way. So it's tangent to the North Pole, but pointing to the west. And if we had done the same thing on the other direction, we would point to the east. So just by virtue of the fact that we're kind of working in a curved manifold, parallel transports of vectors will be delicate. We need to discuss how do we parallel transport vectors and whether in that parallel transport are special entities that we would like to kind of make use of. So suppose if you were kind of a standard flat space-time, and you say, well, given a curve, what would it mean for a vector to be parallel transported along that curve? It would mean that if this is a curve gamma of lambda, the d lambda of whatever vector you have, let's call it this, is equal to 0. In our kind of slowly going through our manifold, and this would have been the same as the xa, the lambda, the dxa of our vector. So let's call it c, right? So this would have been the operation if we were in Rm. So now we want to know what do we have to do in a curved spacetime. And we're going to make our first kind of very simple-minded contact with what we're going to be doing when we try to obtain Einstein equations. We said that if, by the principles of equivalence, all of them, that if we're doing physics in a small enough neighborhood, we should be able to recover every expression that we have. And we want to look at it from a more general point of view. We're going to have to kind of acquire all the machinery that we have been discussing in with respect to manifolds. So one of the things we notice is kind of a partial derivative will have its counterpart in a covariant derivative. And so we're going to use this recipe again and again every time we are trying to make contact with the physics that we knew from before and trying to bring it in the context of general relativity. This will be our first step. Try to then make everything covariant, consistent with the manifold, and ask the question, what I obtained, does it make sense? And if so, then we keep going. And if not, something we might have to fix something. So in the curved case, the notion of parallel transport of a vector will be given by this. Right. Now we know what this thing is. Using our definition, so this will be so. Let me just put it this way. So by promoting our derivative to a covariant derivative, what we are asking is that when we take a derivative along the path, the rate of change along the path plus the connection change along the path, so this thing is notice that this dxb, the lambda basically is telling us the rate of change along the curve. So we have this piece and then that with this one contracting one of the indices. So that would be the requirement for a vector to be parallel transported along the curve. So you can see this in more than one way. So either you're handed a vector, you're handed a curve, and you're asked, is it parallel transported, or you might be handed the curve, you look at a point there, you find the vector v, or sorry, you know what the vector v is at that point, and then you can say, imagine this equation as an initial value problem equation. It's a differential equation that determines how v has to change along the path, because these are things you can change. This will be given. And so if I have v here, I can compute this object at that point. This will tell me how v would have to change in its near neighbor and very slowly build how v has to be changing so that this equation is satisfied. So one trivial observation is this, and this we could have done with any tensor. So one trivial observation is that the metric is parallel transported. Why? Because we define the metric as that object, or the covariant derivative of the object that when it acts on the matrix, it gives a zero. So the metric is parallel transported. So that's a spatial entity. Now, let's suppose this was for any vector. Let's think of the vector v, which is precisely the tangent vector to the curve. So then we would put that thing back in here. And what we would have is the second derivative of xa with respect to lambda twice plus gamma a bc dxb lambda dxc d lambda. That's equal to zero. So that's the definition of a geodesic. The geodesic is an object that parallel transports its vector along itself. And it's the path that unaccelerated particles follow. Think of it in this way. This is something we'll discuss later on. But remember, we have made contact with this before. If we take a small enough region, the space-time can be made arbitrarily flat. I should now pause and give you a caveat on that statement. That is true, provided we're not standing on a singularity, or we're not trying to be at a place where the manifold doesn't have a point. We could take this manifold, and you can because you want, and you cut that ball out. Well, there's nothing I can say there. I mean, I don't have a space. Or I can have a singularity. I can have a true, and when we discuss Schwarzschild solution, say a black hole solution, we're going to have a place where the theory breaks down. So there, it's not true that we can take an arbitrary small neighborhood and consider doing physics as if we were in flat space then. But if we were to do that, let's take a small enough region. It is as flat space-time. In this case, these gammas are zero, so I don't have anything. And what we have is just the acceleration is equal to zero. So this is what we said before. This is unaccelerated particles follow trajectories given by geodesics. Once we look at a neighborhood that's slightly larger than that, we have a contribution from the Christoffel symbols. And this contribution of the Christoffel symbols will precisely kind of unearth for us the role of the gravitational potential, which we're going to get, and this we're going to derive this, we're going to get out of the metric. These are derivative, these gammas, what they are, they're derivatives of metric component. And out of that, we're going to recognize, oh, here is the gravitational potential, and this is the acceleration of particle falling in the gravitational field. One more thing. So let me just say this in a slightly different form. So how did we start? We started saying, well, what's the condition for parallel transporting a tensor, or in this particular case, a vector? And we arrive at this. And out of this, we said that, OK, if we have a trajectory, and we look at the tangent along that trajectory, it gives us our geodesic equation. The geodesic equations are special trajectories. In particular, are trajectories that, and I'm going to say here, remember I use the word extremize. The length in between two points. So if I have points one here and I have a point here, and I said, give me the path that maximizes or extremizes that length. If you go through it, the equations of motion or the equation that determine that path is this, or is analogous to this. You might have a slight change here, which we'll discuss in just a bit. So first thing, suppose you take a time-like curve. So we know, because we have a metric, the time-like curve has to be contained within the cone. And you ask, what type of extrema do I have? So by extrema, we mean either it's the maximum length or the minimum length. And for these kind of trajectories, it would be the maximum length. And the reason for that is that you could imagine point one, point two, and you can get arbitrarily close to going along this trajectory by following null rays. right? So if I go this by changing and always following light trajectories, we know that the distance along a null ray is zero. So there are paths that go from P1 and P2 that are smaller length. So this already tells us kind of intuitively that then we're sticking on a time-like curve, that should be the maximum distance that we can, it will maximize the path length. Is that clear? Okay, so yes.
Why would that, why intuitively would that be the case?
Because there is another path that I can take.
Yeah.
That takes me from here to there with essentially zero length, with an arbitrary small length.
How is it possible to have a maximum length? Is it just because the curvature of our space time means there is maximum length and there's not an infinitely long length? Couldn't you make a really loopy curve that just never even gets there?
No, because our condition is that you do get there. Also, you are quite restricted on the type of loopy. You're not allowed to take this loop.
Okay.
Because you are in a time-like curve.
You can have a loop inside the cone, right?
And then you try.
Can be, infinitely long and still get there.
And it will still give, but yes, you can try, and then it will still give you that it will satisfy this law.
Really? Okay.
So how do you prove this? Well, let me first say yes.
So in general, if we're not thinking about physics, I can understand this being true in the sense that you can just draw that path and compute it and it would be smaller than the geodesic length. But when you add the physics condition, for example, in vacuum, light is not able to take a path like that, which is...
Sure, and you're going to have to be careful with what happened there because you made it go. This is just a heuristic way of saying you can argue that first you're going to show that it has to be an extrema. And an extrema will either say it's the maximum length or the smallest length. And it cannot be the smallest length. Small length, then you go here. And physically, it would be a different story. But here, it's just at this point, if you're doing kinematics.
But is there an argument in general relativity and the vacuum that this thing still holds without invoking the zigzag light path?
You will be still using this argument. So let me say two things about this. So first, that's the geodesic equation, but we also have to be careful that here we have chosen a parameter lambda along the curve. No one says you couldn't use another parameter, let's say alpha of lambda. If you do that, this equation changes. We have to be careful when we say this. So imagine that I have now lambda is a function of another parameter. I have a different parameterization. So lambda or of alpha. So now you can do just a Courier transformation on lambda to get to alpha. Let's just work out through what is the first derivative with respect to lambda in terms of alpha and the second derivative. And when you put all that together, you end up with a slightly different equation, which is this way. For some f of alpha, which I'll give you for completeness, but it's not crucial in what we're going to say now. Something like that. Notice this, if I define the vector, or if I use this notation, ua is d xa d alpha, let's say. What I have in here is the derivative of u with respect to the alpha. Here I have something, and here I have again u. So another way of writing this equation, and I ask you to show this. So this will be exercise 3. So using this definition, prove or show, using our definition of the covariant derivative of the vector, that equation can be written in this way. Some proportionality, let me call it kappa. So in this case, it will be that f. So the geodesic equation is, the general geodesic equation is given by this. So the derivative of a vector, the covariant derivative of a vector along the direction that defines that vector, or over which that vector is defined, along the path over which that vector is defined, is proportional to itself. In the special case that you have chosen a special parametrization of that curve, this thing is 0. But if not, this is the general geodesic equation. You had a question?
Just double checking. So here our function is the second derivative of alpha
with respect to lambda twice.
With respect to lambda divided by
the alpha d lambda square.
Why are we using that?
No, I'm just saying there is a way to define geodesic equations. And in particular, okay, let me say that now. Related to that extremum condition, you might have done this in calculus at some point, I hope. Let's say, have you guys computed geodesics over the sphere? That shows you path that you should take over a sphere to arrive to an extrema of how you join two points. So if you're trying to fly from here to there, and you say, what's the shortest way I can take? Then you have that solution, or one that goes in the opposite direction. But of course, one is the minimum, the other one is the maxima. And to do that, the calculation or the way you arrive at an analog expression, you said, well, let's imagine ds squared is my path. And I want to minimize that path. Ds squared in d lambda, d squared d lambda squared, if this kind of parametrized by d lambda. And you say, how can I extremize this thing? Even that I have a metric or I have a condition to always be on the sphere. If you ask for that, you compute the variation of this to be equal to 0 to make you obtain an extrema, you obtain the geodesic equations, say, for the sphere. So we could do exactly the same thing here and say, well, in between that point and that point, I want to extremize the length of that curve. Let's, for the sake of the argument, imagine that that curve is a curve that is time-like, so it's within the null cone. Then you can say, well, what I'm doing is extremizing what would be the proper time. I want the proper time around point P1 and P2 is given by, again, ds squared. And this will go through next class. Once you do that computation, you arrive at this equation. But you have made a few choices already without perhaps having noticed. And the choice is that this gives you the proper time is already a very significant choice. That is picking the parametrization of that curve. So what I'm trying to make sure we do not forget is that that's one parametrization, the one that gives you a proper time. You could end up getting a time that is here arbitrary, depending on your parametrization. It might not be the proper time. It will be a different time. And so we have to be careful with that. But if you choose a special parametrization, then the result is a 0 here. Up to, well, notice, whenever this parametrization gives you 0, you're going to have a 0 on the right-hand side. And that's, so given a parameter tau that is special, i.e. that gives you a right-hand side at 0, all parameters joined by that by two constants by any linear transformation will also be special because the second derivative will give you 0. So that's just to say that there are many ways to parameterize a curve, And depending on the calculation, it will be very useful to have it be parameterized by this proper time or something called affine parameterization. And these are things that we're going to make contact with when we get to discuss black holes.
Luis?
Yes?
Do you miss the square root in here?
Here? Yeah, but then we're going to take it out. Yes, I did miss it, but right.
It's more important to tau.
Here. Yeah. Sure. Thank you. Yes.
Intervention of that equation that we have for geodesic, like if we want to look at it in the as like a parallel transport thing, then it means that parallel transport shouldn't be dependent on the way we parameterize the curve, right?
Say again, sorry.
Parallel transporting the vector, it shouldn't be it shouldn't depend on the way that we parameterize.
No. One is a curve and you parameterize. Yeah. Then depending on your parameterization, you will have a geodesic equation that satisfies that, or a more general one that satisfies that.
Okay, but a parallel transportation is still valid for that one.
Absolutely, yeah, so we have that. So for the sake of the argument and the time, I think we're going to stop here. The next thing we're going to do is having defined how we parallel transport objects. We're now going to ask, what happens if we transport a vector, let's say, around the curve, and compare what we have when we started with, what we ended up with, the properties of the trajectory that we choose. And out of that, we're going to construct the Riemann tensor. And that Riemann tensor will be the one that we'll use to measure locally where our space sum is curved or not. And out of that object, we're going to construct the key entity that we will get to use to define the equation. Let's stop here. Thank you.
Since we are working with minus crystal, the argument that, let's say, for like, a time rate curve having a maximum time, the null path will have a zero metric, but time rate curve will have a negative metric, so should that not be minimal?
Well, we're taking, again, so we're comparing with respect to this zero, so and we're working in absolute value. You're right. And one will give you the maximum positive number I can get. The other one will give you the maximum negative number that I can get. And I will say it's the maximum negative number, again, by comparing with the fact that I can go and get a smaller one by going through null curves. But you're right. And this is related to what Aldo was saying. When we look at the definition, we're going to be taking the square root of the path length. And for that, we're going to take the absolute value. And then the answer will being distinctive of our signature.
So we can say that for space-like paths as well, the geodesic equation will correspond to the maximum path.
That's right. Using the same relation or the same argument.
So with the exercise that you gave us, is that supposed to be alpha or f of alpha?
F of alpha.
No. I mean here the UB. Nabla B UA is equal to F of alpha?
No, here it's just, I stayed clean. It's going to be proportional to itself.
I think the proportionality is also F of alpha.
Sure, I can put it. I don't want to just didn't keep thinking of the F of alpha. In general, we're going to be doing this. And every time we see this structure, is what I'm trying to stress, we're going to say that this is a geodesic equation. And then the parameterization will let us throw this out or put something here that is convenient. And in the context of black holes, we might see that something here will be the surface gravity of the black hole, and depending on the trajectory we're talking about. But we're going to make contact with that later. Okay, I think we're done and we're being chased out. But do we have another question there?
This is dating way back. When you're writing the Christoffel symbols, sometimes you said this is not a tensor, but sometimes you write the third C up. Like the third index up, and sometimes you write the second index up. How would you raise and lower?
Good. So for Christoffel symbols, you still can raise indices up and down with the metric tensor, but you still recognize that object is not a tensor. So it doesn't have to be a tensor for you to raise the index up and down. You can always do it, because the inner product is defined by the metric. But for it to be called a tensor, it has to have this specific transformation. Thank you.
How did you exactly promote the derivative to Nabla, to so the covariant derivative?
So how do we promote it, if you want? So we said we want a derivative operator that satisfies all the properties I mentioned, right? And once you set all the properties, you can prove that there is a unique covariant derivative that satisfies those properties.
Why is it unique exactly?
Oh, we haven't seen that yet. We're going to show that. I promise for the time being. So there is a unique metric that does that. But we ask for it a lot, right? We ask that it's consistent with the partial derivatives on scalar that satisfies linearity and Leibniz. We also require that we are dealing with a torsion-free spacetime, and that will give us a unique derivative associated to it. Say again.
The null trajectory, can it be a geodesic?
Yes, absolutely. And this is why I also wasn't too strongly attached to some of these things. Yes, it's a geodesic. We can find geodesics that are null. What we're not going to be able to do is to assign or determine a proper time parameterization. That doesn't exist. So for that, we're going to introduce another thing, which is this affine parameterization, which will tell us if you want the clock rate for the observer. The null observer along this is ticks at a unit rate, for instance. That will allow us to introduce a preferred parameter along a null geodesic. But you're right, and that was an excellent question. Null geodesics do not have a proper time parameterization that we can get our hands on.
And their path will always correspond to the minimum.
That's right. Yeah. And we'll have zero length by definition.
What did you say the affine parameter corresponds to?
It's for the clock to tick at a unit rate. So we're going to be saying the lambda of the first component equal to 1. So that allows us to say, well, okay, we chose something that has a particular ticking rate, and that's as good a parameter as anything else, but okay, that we can choose.